Your plaintiff side employment, that can mean a lot of things. Maybe you do all of them. But is there a specific niche within the niche that you take care of, or do you sort of do anything plaintiff side?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And we've narrowed it down. So to answer your question, no, we don't do it all. We tried to for a while, but as maybe this is true of other practice areas as well. But, you know, within employment law, even plaintiff side, there are, right? You could do nothing but wage an hour. You could, you know, focus on non-competes. You could, just do discrimination cases. So we represent individuals. So we don't do collective or class actions. We tried that for a while and realized that, you know, it just wasn't our wheelhouse. And also, you know, we can kind of get into this a little bit more, but in terms of the marketing, you know, it's a different pain point for people when you're talking to individuals versus, you know, a class.
Welcome to the Founding Partner Podcast. Join your host, Jonathan Hawkins, as we explore the fascinating stories of successful law firm founders. We'll uncover their beginnings, triumph over challenges, and practice growth. Whether you aspire to launch your own firm, have an entrepreneurial spirit, or are just curious about the legal business, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Founding Partner Podcast. I'm Jonathan Hawkins, your host. Really excited about this week's guest. This week we have Tom Spiegel, who is a plaintiff side employment lawyer out of Virginia, who is pretty prolific in his marketing efforts. And I'm very impressed. We're going to get into all the stuff he does and how he sort of layered that on. I really want to dig into that. But Tom, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us who you are and where you
absolutely.
Are.
I appreciate it, Jonathan. This is going to be some fun. And yeah, like you said, I plaintiff side employment attorney. We are out of Alexandria, Virginia, so right outside of Washington, D.C., and we represent folks in primarily in the DMV, so Maryland, D.C., Virginia. We do take some cases in North Carolina, Texas, and North Carolina, which is where we have folks barred, but our primary hub is here in the DMV.
So how many people are at your firm? How many attorneys, how many staff, how many offices?
Yeah, so we have eight attorneys, people total. We only have, you know, like we said, we operate in a number of areas, but we only have one brick and mortar location, which is in Alexandria. But, you know, as I think with a lot of firms these days, we have people all over, you know, not only in the States, but, you know, working, you know, Mexico, South Africa, you know, kind of remote workers. So that's sort of our stats.
That's a big operation. I want to hear the evolution, but so your plaintiff side employment, that can mean a lot of things. Maybe you do all of them, but is there a specific niche within the niche that you take care of, or do you sort of do anything plaintiff side?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And we've narrowed it down. So to answer your question, no, we don't do it all. We tried to for a while, but as maybe this is true of other practice areas as well, but you know, within employment law, even plaintiff side, there are, right, you could do nothing but wage an hour. You could, you know, focus on non-competes. You could, you know, just do discrimination cases. So we represent individuals. So we don't do collective or class actions. We tried that for a while and realized that, you know, it just wasn't our wheelhouse. And also, you know, we can kind of get into this a little bit more, but in terms of the marketing, you know, it's a different pain point for people when you're talking to individuals versus, you know, a class. So we only represent individuals. And within that, we do the range of services. So whether it's a discrimination matter or, you know, we're occasionally on the other side of the V. So we'll represent, you know, folks in a defensive action, like it's somebody getting sued for non-compete violation, occasionally breach of contract will come up. So that's sort of our wheelhouse.
So I know you started out in criminal law. How did you, number one, tell us what you began doing, and then how did you move from that into what you're doing now?
Yeah, I actually started out in civil. Okay. I graduated from Georgetown in 2001 and then went back to North Carolina, where I'm from, and worked with a sort of a mid-sized firm called Therrington Smith down there in Raleigh, North Carolina, and was in their education practice. So we represented school boards in all manner of You know, basically, we were their outside general counsel. So as part of that, we handled a fair amount of litigation, including employment litigation. So that's how I got my first taste in it, was actually on defense side, which was a little bit interesting because a lot of us, you know, in education, in that field, you know, we're sort of bleeding hearts and, you know, want to make the system better. And then we realized that, well, we're firing people, we're suspending, you know, if there was a student suspension appeal, we're coming in there to try to kick that poor student out. I mean, it was good work. I mean, I don't mean to shortchange it, but it was definitely management side. But that's where I got my first taste of it. I actually didn't take any of those classes in law school, but loved the intellectual challenge of it. Loved that people on both sides took it very seriously, right? And it wasn't just kind of a business dispute getting resolved in the courts. You know, people really, you know, took these matters personally. So I love that. So that I did that for about 2 years. My now wife and I, we met in law school and she stayed in DC. And then, so we got engaged. I'm like, well, somebody's got to move. And she's from Connecticut. And she said, well, I'm not moving any further south than right here. So back I went to DC and ended up clerking in DC Superior Court for Jeb Boasberg. He's now the chief judge of the DC Federal Court, just a really impressive guy. And he was, you know, a hotshot from the US Attorney's Office. And I told him I wanted to learn how to try cases because I had been doing, you know, litigation, I mean, you know, as a very junior associate, but a few depositions here or there. But a lot of the folks that I worked with didn't try a lot of cases. Maybe they tried one or two in their entire career. And I wanted, you know, I wanted to have more notches on my belt than that. So he was the one who's like, well, you should go to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Well, he said, you should go criminal defense, I mean, criminal side, because you're going to get more trial experience. And I'm like, you know, so he said, I'm happy to, you know, to, if you wanted to do the U.S. Attorney's Office, I'm happy to support you. And so I applied out of the clerkship and got all the way to the final interview and did not get it. Went to work for because I didn't have much of a criminal background. So I went to work for a white collar boutique in DC that those guys have all retired. It's no longer in existence. It was called Janice Schulke and Wexler. And they were all, it's an interesting group of folks because they were all former AUSAs. They had come up during the Watergate era. And then they opened their shop before kind of white collar defense was, it was considered by the big firms to be not classy enough to do it. So a lot of the big firms didn't do white collar defense. And so, and it really started to boom after the Watergate era. So they really hit that wave just right. And it was a great 2 years. I was the only associate there. They only had one associate at the time. And basically, because they would represent mostly individuals. So, you know, their buddies, former colleagues at the U.S., many of them at the U.S. Attorney's Office were at these big firms. The big firms would take the companies and represent them and send these guys, like, you know, the CFO. Sometimes they had criminal exposure and sometimes it was just a matter of kind of walking them through the grand jury. But it was a lot of fun and I learned a lot and then reapplied to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And that's how I ended up there. And then, you know, there for a number of years and really enjoyed, it was a great job, enjoyed that, but all sort of had an itch to start my own practice and finally wore my wife down to enough to where she said, you know, she was pregnant with our third and she said, okay, you got 9 months to make this work. I'm like, okay. Uh-oh. Well, it only took me about, I don't know, 9 years, but it was too late. You know, the seal had been broken and I was off to the races.
U.S. Attorney's Office won't have me back. I have to do it.
That's right.
So that's cool. So what was the itch? Why did you want to start your own firm? Are you sort of an entrepreneur at heart? I've followed you on LinkedIn. I've looked at your website. I've seen a lot of the stuff you're doing. You got a podcast. We'll talk about all that. So it seems to me that you sort of have this in you, but maybe it's something you developed later.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I really, I do think I have some entrepreneurial tendencies, but I was not one of those kids who was like selling bubblegum to their classmates, you know, in elementary school and always had kind of, I was not that guy. That said, my father, now retired, but he was a doctor, solo practitioner. So without thinking about it, I think I did sort of absorb some of that and just saw how he lived his life and what that was like. And it really was when I was clerking, this was in 2003. This is back when blogs were just becoming a thing. And I'm sure you probably have heard of her, but Carolyn Elephant had a blog called My Shingle, and she was writing about her experience. And then she had just started. I think she was a couple of years out, and I was just in a swoon. I mean, I just read that. And I'm like, that was what really lit the fire for me and got me thinking about it. And once that started, it was like, you know, like a mind virus. I couldn't get rid of it. So that was the impetus.
So you decided to start your own firm. Did you decide at that time you're going to do plaintiff side employment? Or tell us about sort of picking that. Or what did you start out with, and how did you end up in your niche now?
Sure. Yeah, I kind of shudder at what I didn't know when I started. I can't even remember, frankly, what I thought I was going to do. I mean, I remember talking to my wife and be like, hey, look, all I got to do is bill this many hours at this rate. I'll easily be able to replace my salary at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I think that was about my level of sophistication with it. Yeah, so
I have had a very similar conversation. I know that conversation.
And the math didn't quite work out, not immediately anyway. But so, yeah, so I, you know, when I started, I was all over the map. I mean, I did want to do litigation, and I did a fair amount of that. I still want to do plaintiff side. So I've always had that interest. And in fact, I, you know, even when I was working at these, you know, the criminal defense side firm, I did a number of pro bono. I was involved with the National Employment Lawyers Association, which is the big, you know, federal plaintiff side bar, and also the local chapter, and was with a group that, you know, I think it's been absorbed by the Committee for Civil Rights, but it used to be they did pro bono work. They had a clinic and they did pro bono work for folks with employment issues, and ones that had legs, you know, like actual need to be filed, they would send them out to folks to do. And so I took one of those cases, which was my first, you know, even while I was at Janus Schulke and Wexler. So I had that interest. But I can remember, I did one will, and I think I probably made about $5.13 an hour as I realized, like, I had no idea what I was doing when it came to like trust and estates, and I had to take the CLEs and all that. But pretty quickly from there, I, you know, focused on litigation. I did some criminal defense, got on the CJA panels in DC and Virginia. And then started taking other related civil litigation. I was, I was interested in plaintiff side and started kind of holding myself out for that and started to get a fair number of referrals. And I quickly realized that why I was getting these referrals, and that's because Virginia, it's gotten better. It's still not great, but it was a rocky jurisdiction to do plaintiff side work. So people were sending me these cases. I'm like, oh, I must be the man. then I got, you know, slapped down on summary judgment a couple of times. I'm like, okay, this is why they're sending me these cases. But so I had sort of that mix of cases I was doing. And then I sort of backed into hiring people. Like when I started, I mean, it was just me. I mean, I had a laptop with a cracked screen, so I had to get an external monitor so I could see it. And, you know, a little bit of office furniture, but that was it. I mean, I was attorney, paralegal, chief bottle washer, you know, you name it. And this was in 2009, 2010, when the economy was in the tank. Mm-hmm. And I had a case that I got that was a big federal civil litigation in the Eastern District of Virginia that was like hot and heavy. And I had co-counsel, who's actually one of my former Georgetown professors, co-counsel. And we were like, we need somebody. He didn't have a big shop either. And we're like, we need some help. And I put an ad. I'm like, I was just looking for a law clerk to help me go through the documents. And I got so many borrowed attorneys who were just desperate for work. So I ended, and you know, I hired one or two just kind of on a part-time basis. And then, you know, quickly realized what law firms have been, you know, realized for the past 1,000 years, which is, hey, if I can pay you X and bill you out at, you know, 3X, this is not a bad deal. So I did have some associates, but it was, you know, when you don't have a niche, when you don't really, I mean, I was just sort of feeling my way along. I mean, it was hard, you know, I mean, it was definitely, you know, long hours. I wasn't particularly efficient, and I started following a guy named Lee Rosen, who you may have heard of. Mm. And this was back when he still owned his firm and he was just getting into the coaching business. And he just getting the power of marketing. He had this blog, which he would just, you know, post his thoughts on law firm management. And I just, every morning I would just devour that thing. And it was like, you talk about good marketing. It was like he was in my head, you know, mm-hmm. It was like, he was like, you know, he would write about things that I would think it had only happened to me. And it was like so comforting to read and be like, oh, okay, this is like, this is not just me, you know, and my tale of woe, this is like a kind of thing. So I called him, and it's interesting. I knew of his firm when I was in Raleigh because that's where his firm was. So I knew of him, but I'd never met him. So I called him, and I think he was doing some, he just started doing individual coaching, and I hired him as a coach. And he was fantastic. But one of the first things he said was, he's like, you got to pick a niche. He's like, I don't care which one it is, like, you know, but pick one area that you want to focus on. And I'm like, okay, I want to do plaintiff side employment. And it was scary. I remember because, I mean, I was probably doing a good bit of plaintiff side work then. It was probably 50, 60% of my revenue, but the other cases were 30 to 40 of it. So to let go of that and to kind of, you know, just jump into that. And then he said, you got to write a book. He said, I don't care what the book says. It's got to have a good title and a good cover. You know, you just want it to get SEO and to get press coverage. So that's what I did. And I just ran his program straight down the middle. And he was exactly right.
So let's pause on that. So a couple of things you said, you know, a lot of lawyers, not all of them, but that go out on their own, they're like you, that you got 9 months to start making it work. So you're like, right. I'm going to do anything and everything just to get money in the door. And, you know, it's scary and you want the money and that's good. But then you quickly realize how inefficient it is when you're doing a will here and then you're doing a dispossessory over here and then you're doing a whatever over there. And so, you know, that's a common experience. And the other thing I'll say, you know, big believer in the niche practice is sort of like almost by removal of the other things. You slowly start removing things. And then, you know, I was part of Lee's program, I don't know, a few years ago. You were there in the beginning, but I don't think he had sold his firm yet. It was close around that time though, but you know, he was traveling the world. I thought that was pretty cool. But your marketing stack, you were doing a lot of cool stuff and we're going to go through all of it. So I guess the first thing is, was it Lee Rosen that helped you figure that out or started you down the path? How did you, I guess, was the book really the first thing you did?
This is one of the things I wish I had done. I wish I'd kept a journal, you know, just a whole, and I'm not a great journaler. I know some people are. I wish I had because I can't remember. I think I was doing some marketing. I knew I had a website. So, you know, I was always interested in marketing and I think I was doing some writing, you know, some blogs, but, you know, really picking the niche is what helped me start to focus on that. But Lee was certainly the big impetus. I mean, he was the one. I mean, I know I had been doing some because, you know, when it came time to write the book, he was like, well, just take all of your blogs. And that's, you know, that's the first bit of it. And that's what I did. So I collected all these blog posts, you know, and that was, so I had already been doing that, but he was the one who, you know, just what he did. He's like, you know, pick your niche, figure out what people's pain points are, which, you know, because they're coming into your office and they're telling you what their pain points are, like what keeps them up at night, and then write to them. Like, don't write to another lawyer, which I think would be fine if you've got an appellate practice. But if you're B2C and you're trying to get these clients to call you, you know, write to their pain points. And so he was probably the big impetus behind that. And I remember, you know, he kept having to kind of redirect me, you know, like I would come to him with some great idea and he'd be like, no, just back to employment law, just keep writing, keep pushing in that area. Cause I remember I had an attorney who did special education work and I'm like, well, this is related. So we'll start writing about, you know, students and all that. And he was like, no, he's like, you're just going to confuse Google, you know, just stay in your lane. So he was the big impetus for it.
Okay. So you've written two books now, I know. You've got a new one that's out. And I want to hear about, you mentioned a little bit about the first one. So you took some blog posts. I want to hear about your process and how you did it, how long it took you, you know, what resources you went to employ in terms of, you know, the cover design, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And compare that first go around with the book to what you did this last go around.
Yeah. So the first time, again, I relied on Lee quite a bit. I mean, I obviously wrote the book myself and I just, like I said, I, you know, took those, you know, however many blog posts I had, and that was probably the first half of it. And then I would just sit, like, you know, after we'd gotten the kids down to bed, you know, they got that golden hour, maybe hour and a half. And I would just sit on the couch. We'd have our, you know, TV show on and I would just write. And I didn't try to make it. Didn't try to make a narrative. I just kind of just started as if I were speaking to someone who was with me in a consult. And I realized, like, when you write that way, like, and you're not writing a law review article or something like that, like, for me at least, I imagine probably for most folks who do what we do, it comes pretty quick. You have a lot. I mean, there's a lot, you know, I was surprised, you know, because there was a lot I had to say about it. And so it probably took me 10 months, maybe a year to finally get it, get the final, well, to get all the material down. And then I hired a writer who is a lawyer, who her name is Kristen Walensky. She's still out there. She does great work. And again, Lee pointed me to her, and I just like was like, here's all my, here's this, you know, manuscript, like turn it into just like chapters and headings and all that. Because that was another thing that Lee, he was the one that really kind of turned me on to the idea of delegation, mm-hmm. you know, in those areas where, like, because he talked about, like, for his, because he was obviously a prolific writer, and he would say for himself that for his blog post, he would often get stuck on putting in, he'd get the thing written, he'd get 90% the way there, but he'd get stuck on the headings and the graphics and all that. And he quickly realized, like, look, if I can just do the writing and then send it to somebody who was Kristen and say, put in the heading, put in the graphics, and then post it for me, like, then things started to move for him. And so that was one big thing. So she turned it into, you know, a usable manuscript, and which went through many iterations after that. I mean, anybody who's written a book, I mean, if this happened to me the second time, like, it almost like you invariably, I don't care how many times you read it, you'll still find a typo somewhere. And, you know, you're like, then I get paranoid. I'm like, there are typos everywhere. Do I need to go back through this whole thing again?
And they're highlighted and they're flashing and everybody's going to see it, right?
Exactly right. Nobody else, right? So nobody else notices, but you notice, right? So we got a cover designer off of, I believe it was off Upwork, which is a, you may have used, but it's a platform you go and you can post for anything. I've gotten so much help off of Upwork, but that's where I went and I found a cover designer who designed the cover for us. And then I used a company that has since been bought by Google. I think it is now, if not completely, or at least part of their Kindle Direct program, but this company was called CreateSpace, and they would like, actually, at the time, they would even do the cover and all that, but I already had that done. But they would do all the stuff that I didn't realize. Like, you feel like the hardest part is writing the book, and it is a hard part, but like, you're like, okay, it's done. Typers are mostly out of it. You know, you hand off somebody and they're like, well, what kind of page stock do you want? How big do you want the book to be? What kind of font do you want? And I'm like, I just do a book. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So they worked with me on that to kind of get those details done. And then they put it up on Kindle, I mean, up on Amazon, and did all the hard copies. So that's how I got the first one done.
And how did you use it to market? I mean, do you have it on your website? I mean, obviously, yeah. If a client comes in, you just hand them a copy. I mean, how did you employ it?
Yeah. I mean, certainly any kind of networking stuff that I did, you know, I would send people a book afterwards. I'm sure a good many of them end up in the trash recycling, but it's harder to throw away a book than it is a business card. So I used it that way. But the other pro tip, and again, I go back to Lee, he was the one who, he's like, you know, you got to get somebody, a PR agent. He's like, writing the book is only half of it. You got to get somebody out there to push it for you. So I did. I hired a PR person who's fantastic. She's still out there. Her name is Allison Beckwith. She's in Maryland, former press person who now does PR stuff. And she was just phenomenal. I mean, she really, I mean, part of it was certainly her work. And part of it was, you know, I'd picked a good topic. There weren't many men. There weren't many books out at all, but there certainly weren't many men writing about pregnancy discrimination. So it was just sort of an interesting hook for, you know, for reporters. And, you know, this, because going back to what Lee said, he's like, you want a book with a good title, you know, and a nice cover, because he's like, press people want somebody with authority, and they want to be able to say, Tom Spiegel, author of whatever. And he's like, they're probably not going to read your book. They just want, you know, they've got stories they got to produce. They've got to find experts. And he says, once you find one or two, like, you'll be in their Rolodex and they'll come back to you for other stories, which turned out to be exactly right. So I ended up, I don't have the book necessarily, but I got quoted in the New York Times, got me on CNN. Like, it got me just a lot of, you know, a lot of press, which then resulted in a lot of backlinks to the website. And then, you know, another thing that I did was, you know, so I'd taken half the first half of the book off my current writings. The second half of the book, I took them from the book and put them back on my website. So again, another tip from Lee, he's like, don't be precious about what you write. Nobody's reading it so closely that they're going to notice you have it in eight different places. So, you know, just kind of repurpose it. So that's what I did.
That's cool. So you got the book, you're getting in the media. How did you start to add to your stack? I know I'll list some of the things I know you do now. So mm-hmm. You got your email newsletter, you've got a podcast, maybe you have more than mm-hmm. one. You've got, you know, you're on social media, you probably do some other stuff too. So take us through mm-hmm. your stack, and then how did you begin to layer that on? Because you can't do it all at once. That's the other thing.
Exactly right.
Somebody comes out, I mean, they look at you and your website and they're like, holy crap, there's no way I'm ever going to be like Tom and be able to do that. But, you know, it doesn't happen overnight, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think for me, I mean, I've always been a little bit of a frustrated law professor, right? I like to write, I like to teach. And so I don't know if compulsively is the right word, but I just did that naturally. You know, I was like writing. So to your question, it really started with the website. So that for a long time, that was my main game. That and just, you know, shoe leather networking. That was a big piece of it too for me in the beginning. But in terms of like digital marketing, it was just, you know, writing stuff on the website, you know, constantly adding, you know, obviously the game has changed quite a bit, but back in the day, you know, it was blogging, right? That was the thing. And so just regularly get out there and blogging was a big piece of it. And then constantly trying to iterate on the website to provide things that would be useful to our potential clients. So for instance, one of the things I did again through Upwork was I hired, you know, I not developed in the sense of the back end, but I'm like, okay, I want to figure out a calculator that somebody can use to get a kind of a, you know, a broad stroke look at what the damages in their case might be. And so I went on Upwork and I was like, hey, this, I didn't know what to call it this time. I'm looking for somebody to help me with a calculator. And I found this dude in India who did it for me for like $500. And I bet that thing, don't know for certain, but I would be not surprised if that didn't generate many six figures in revenue, because right, you put the calculator on the website and then you do the email drip, right? Because people got to put in their email to get access to the calendar, which is the way I did it. And then I just had this drip campaign follow-up email that I used. And so it was things like that. So it really started with the website as the anchor. And then the other things really flowed from that. And I think to your point, like if you can get some traction in one area, then you get the revenue and the space to try other things like podcasts and social media. And because the trick is always like, how much of it do you want to do yourself and how much do you want to hire somebody to do it? Like that was kind of the anchor, and then everything else flowed from that.
So what's, tell me about your podcast. Let's plug it. What's the name? You know, how often do you publish? Who's it geared towards?
So I've had a couple of podcasts. I did one called Parents at Work, which again was designed, you know, because one of our niches within our niche is representing like pregnancy discrimination, caregiver discrimination. And so I wanted, and this is true of at least my second layer of marketing, is trying to stay in front of my audience before they need me, right? Because I think this is true for plaintiff side in particular, you know, when somebody has the accident, when somebody gets fired, you know, they're out there looking for the attorney, but those are the, and you should be looking for those people, of course, but those are the most expensive people to get, right? They don't know you. You've got to develop, the trust and like you piece before they're even going to pick up the phone. So the objective was for me was to try to be in front of people. And most people have better things to do than worry about whatever your specific area of law is, right? Like my ideal clients are not out there thinking, wow, what's the Fourth Circuit doing on, you know, on Title VII discrimination cases these days? They've got other things. So I wanted to be in front of them in a different way. So we started out with just me, and then it was with another attorney, Lori Mihalik-Levin, fantastic. And she had her own, I'm a blank on the name of it, but her own e-course for attorneys mostly who had had a child and were returning to work and kind of had to navigate that path. Oh man, I'm blanking. But anyway, so she and I co-hosted it, and we would interview people in various, you know, like in accounting and legal and tech, you know, who had kids and like, basically, how are you making this work? So I did that for a while. And this is just, you know, part of my personality. I'll kind of start things and get tired of them. And so I did that for about a year. And I just started to to kind of lose my mojo, even though I thought it was a great podcast and I love working with Lori. But I'm like, Lori, do you want to just take this and run with it? And she's like, sure. So now she and her husband do Parents at Work. And then it was a while, it was probably another maybe year, another 2 years before I started another podcast. And it started out called I Got Fired, again, you know, toward my target audience. And the subject matter was what you might expect. I mean, talk about really more narrow employment law issues. And that was more towards, you know, people who've got that burning need. We then renamed it the Spiegel Law Podcast because I wanted to broaden out some of the things I wanted to talk about. I didn't want to have to just be in that lane. So that's what I do now. I do a mix of, you know, kind of employment law topics and law firm management issues. I'm not an expert at it, but I'm very interested in AI. So some discussions about AI in the legal field. So that's the podcast now.
That's cool.
And we do it weekly.
Okay. Real quick, thanks for listening. If you're getting any value out of this podcast, please take 2 seconds to hit the subscribe button and leave a 5-star review. It would really mean a lot to me. Now back to the show. So there's another thing that I think is pretty cool just from looking at your website, and I came across something that's called the Legal Leverage Program, and it has a trademark symbol on it.
Yeah.
So number one, it's intriguing and enticing. I was like, what is that? So tell me about that and what is it? And I like that you got the trademark on it.
Yeah. So this was a video course that I first developed 3 or 4 years ago. We've since reshot it at least one time, but it is basically how describing to a layperson or somebody who's trying to go it on their own, or at least doing their own research, like how somebody, an expert, would evaluate their case, right? Because there are just certain steps that we take, and anybody in my field takes when evaluating a case. And so the idea, the legal leverage, was, you know, using the legal system to apply force to the lever to move your employer or to reach your objective, and that leverage changes depending on where you are in the process and how far and how many resources you're willing to put into it. So I really start out with the first module is on damages, right? Because, you know, it's interesting, and you may have noticed this in your field, like in some ways it's elemental, but like sometimes it takes you years and years of doing something to be like, oh, like, why don't we just switch these two pieces? And so my thing was like, let's start with damages, right? We'll get to whether you have a case, and that's obviously an important piece of it. But a lot of times, you know, I'll get, and I'm always welcome referrals, but I'll get people call me or I'll get cases referred to me, and I'm like, there's just no damages here. Like, even if I can prove, you know, that there's a violation of the law, like the juice is just not worth the squeeze on this one. So that's part of it. It's like explaining that concept to people, you know, and because we get people all the time who, you know, bad stuff has happened to them at work, and they'll come and I'll be like, yeah, this is bad stuff that happened. It may even be illegal, but like, we can go all the way through a federal trial and you're going to get max $30,000. Yeah, we're going to make $200,000.
You got a raise. So, right. You know, it's funny you say that. I was last week at a presentation, a MedMal plaintiff's lawyer. He was going through how he evaluates a case and damages. First thing he's like, it's got to be big damages.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so I think a lot of people are surprised by that. You know, they'll come in and they think they're going to be big emotional distress damages. And I'm like, yes, there are some damages here. But again, getting back to the legal leverage portion of it, like if what you want is to negotiate a, you know, 10% better severance, yeah, you got some leverage here, right? Because the employer wants to avoid this. There is some smoke here, maybe some fire, you know, so you've got some leverage. If you want a 10%, you know, better severance, we can do that because you've got some damages. If you want $100,000 or more, like you just don't have the leverage for that because the other side's, you know, knowledgeable employment attorney is going to do the same thing I did and be like, hey, we'd love to get rid of this, but you've got $30,000 in damages. So that is to try to, you know, the whole course is designed to, and again, for a lawyer, it'd be fairly elemental, but it's like, you know, let's start with the damages. Let's figure that out. Let's look at the liability of your case. And of course, you know, I mean, you're not going to be an attorney, the person who's reading it, who's a layperson, but I try to walk them through, you know, kind of broad strokes, how an attorney would look at this. And then, you know, just, you know, provide a weighted average, you know, based on everything you know about your case, you know, do you have emails? Do you have documents? How strong are your witnesses? Scale of 1 to 10, how would you evaluate your case? Again, always, it's in the book. It's in the course. Like, it's always better to talk to an attorney. That's where you're going to get the real rub. But like, you know, a smart person could do this. Is it 6 out of 10? Is it 8 out of 10? And then take that and multiply it toward, you know, to the value, the damages that you've calculated. And so, you know, if you've got $100,000 for the damages and 80%, you know, on liability, then you've got an $80,000 case. And then helping people understand that, you know, you generally are not going to get that 80,000 unless you push way into the process, right? So you, and if you want, that's great, you know, but know that from the outset. Whereas if, you know, if you want 30,000, well, you can probably get that a lot quicker. And what is, you know, there's no right or wrong answer to this, but what is the value of your time, your money? Like, you know, if you could get $30,000 now, would you rather have that? Or would you rather wait for 2 years and full tilt litigation to get double that, you know? And some people, you know, they're willing to do that, but that's the, what the legal leverage program.
So it's a, like a video course for basically potential clients out there. So how do you deliver it? Do they have to sign up for it? How do they find it? How do they sign up for it?
Yeah. So our clients get it for free. We give them, you know, they get the access code. And then if for people who want to purchase it, and I forget what we priced it at, but it's just on the website. They go, you know, you enter your email and, you know, well, you get, I think that you get some, it's been a while since I've looked at the marketing follow-up on that, but I think you get some snippets of what the videos are like. And there's also a workbook that comes with it. And so then you enter email, there's an invoice sent. If you want to buy it, then you buy it. And then we also have a Facebook group associated with it, because that's the other piece, right? For employment law, probably for all legal issues, but certainly for employment law, it can be very isolating, right? Like, you are on your own dealing with this very, yes, you've got your attorney, but you know, you don't really have a community. Yeah, there are some attorney client issues. I mean, that, you know, there, we, something we have to be dealt with, but with the Facebook group, it can be anonymous. So people can post there anonymously and ask questions or share their stories. And so the idea is, you know, to give people some sense of their options, even if they don't hire an attorney. And obviously that's the best way to go, but even if they don't hire an attorney, because a lot of people, right, they can do their own demand letter. They can take the first swing at it on their own if they're willing to do that, and to help them through that situation. And then for people who are going further, you know, in litigating or working with an attorney, you know, giving them that support and the knowledge they need to be an educated consumer.
So that's pretty cool. So it's, you're not getting rich off of it, but it is a revenue stream, number one. And maybe more importantly, it's almost like a pre-screening. It probably takes a little load off your intake, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
They sort of pre-screen themselves. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So shifting gears a little bit. So, you know, your firm, you said you've got like 42 people now. I assume, you tell me, but I assume you're sort of in the CEO role now. Do you do any legal work anymore?
Nope.
Okay. In the CEO role, obviously you do marketing, because I see everything. What about sales? And by sales, I mean, you're in the consult room when somebody calls in. Do you do that anymore?
Nope.
So how, okay, this is awesome. So how did you move? That's the question. How did you move to where you are now?
Yeah.
Is it mindset? You know, how'd you get the pieces in place? How did you get there, and how long did it take?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so after I worked with Lee, and so Lee at the time would only work with you for 14 months. And so, because his thing was like, after 14 months, you'll no longer be scared of me. You're just going to tell me what I want to hear. I'm not going to be abused to you. I don't know if that's exactly true, but I worked with him for that 14 months and then stopped. And then I think it was and I think this is one of the things you had a question about, but I went to Strategic Coach, which was another coaching group. It's a non-attorney coaching group run by a guy named, he doesn't do much of his own coaching anymore, but Dan Sullivan, who's just fantastic. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
I am. Yeah. I know Strategic Coach. I have not done it, but I do want to get into that. I'm very curious about the program and what you got out of it.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I did it for 3 years and loved it. And, you know, I would go back to that one eventually, I think. I learned a lot of kind of the high level, not high level, but like entrepreneurial ideas there first. Like, really, you know, Lee had turned me on to some of it, like the delegation, the packaging of your intellectual property, kind of how to think about, and it just, it was also great to just be in a room with a bunch of other entrepreneurs, most of whom were not lawyers. So it was interesting to get the perspective from other fields. So I did that for 3 years, again, which I thought was fantastic, but I felt like, which ended up being true, I needed more of kind of a tactical, you know, nuts and bolts, like how does it work in a law firm? Because that's, you're not going to get that necessarily a strategic coach. It's going to be a higher level kind of training. So then I joined How to Manage a Small Law Firm. And that is where I really, I was already primed by strategic coach. So I was a step ahead in the sense of the way, like some of the concepts they would talk about. Like, I think for a lot of attorneys in the room, it was the first time they had heard them. It was not the first time I had heard them. I'm like, I'm all in, just tell me how, right? Tell me the nuts and bolts. And also, I mean, just being with a group of people who had a similar objective, which was to build, for me anyway, to build an organization that could run without you having to steer, right? Be there and steering the wheel the whole time. Another great book on the topic, which also a great podcast, Built to Sell. Love that book and great love that book. Podcast. Great and book. Anyway, so to get to your question, probably the first big leap for me, I mean, so I was already, hold on, I got to plug my computer in real quick. I didn't realize it wasn't plugged in. Give me 1 second.
Yep.
Sorry about that. I got the notification it was about to die and I'm like, why is it? And I saw the plugs in here. So we'll start over. So one of the big things for me was, because I was already, you know, already had associates. I was already delegating, you know, a lot of the work down to them. And just a quick aside on that, the first time I even thought about that possibility, I remember I was with one of my early callers with Lee Rosen and I was talking to him and I'm like, hey, you know, he just kind of asked me like, why I reached out to him. And I'm like, well, I got all these things I want to do and all this marketing and I can't seem to get it done. And he's like, well, why not? And I'm like, well, I got all these clients, I got all these kids. And he's like, well, you've got attorneys working with you, right? I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, have them do the work. And I was just like dumbfounded. I'm like, you can do that? He's like, yeah, that's how you grow any business. Like you have somebody else like do the production while you go out and grow the business. And so I immediately went back and was like, you're managing attorney. You two are reporting to him, which went about as well as you might imagine something like that would go. It was wasn't quite a disaster. But let me say, I had to clean up a lot of messes.
Yeah.
Because I didn't. And again, I learned this as a strategic coach. You got to delegate, not abdicate. And I was just like, here, you guys go have fun with this. And I'm going to go market and sell and do all that kind of stuff. And it took me years to get to the point where I wasn't doing most of the legal work. But the big piece for me with How to Manage, which was kind of mind-blowing for me at the time, is like hiring non-attorney salespeople, which was not even something, I would never have come to that on my own. And I just couldn't wrap my head around how to do that. And Arjun Robbins, he's the one who started How to Manage. It was already pretty sizable when I got there. And he had a course called How to Train Your Dragon, right? Named after the movie. And it was, as it sounded, it was like how they call them dragons, the sales, you know, the people who would do sales. And it was how to train them to sell legal services. And so it was to train non-attorney salespeople, but you could, as the attorney, go through the program yourself. And so that's what I did. I signed up for, because I'm like, how does this even happen? And I went through the program and after I finished it, I'm like, I'm not sure how I managed to sell legal services at all to this point. Like, because you realize there is an art to it. And I think most entrepreneurs, I mean, certainly people who start their own businesses are naturally good at it to a certain extent. So I'm being a little bit facetious, but about realizing that there is an art to it that can be learned and that a good bit of it does not only does it not require an attorney, but attorney will often muck it up. Right? Because an attorney, what they said in How to Manage, Like, you always want to take them to the sausage factory. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to file this. And some of that is good, right? It develops trust with the client, but it doesn't address what their issues are, right? I mean, if you start, as I did after that, started reading, you know, reading books on sales, like they say, you know, sell the sizzle, not the steak, right? Like, you got to talk to them where they are and what their ambitions are. And so I came back, and still then I was doing a decent amount. Well, let me back up. I had attorneys doing, my other attorneys doing the initial consults, and I was still doing some. So we were all sort of doing the consults. And when I went through the sales training, I had no idea there was something called a conversion rate. I didn't even know what that meant. And they set me down and they're like, well, your conversion rate is you've got so many potential clients sort of coming in. So many of them are converted to clients. Like, what's that percentage? And it was terrible. Like, when I actually calculated it, it was like 14%.
Oh, wow.
And, it was awful. Wow. It was awful. And that's just because it wasn't the attorneys were great attorneys. There just weren't. That's not what they were. And some of them were better than others. Some of them were quite good. And some of them were, you know, just, you might as well be throwing those leads into a black hole just because that was just not their skill set to convert them. And that was a big piece for me, too, because, again, I think a lot of issues, and I got this from somebody else, in any small business really come down to simple math. Right? If you can do the simple math, you can figure it out. And once I sat down, because before then I had been like, market. I need to market more, website, more leads. And when they were like, look, if you can change your conversion rate from 14% to just 25%, like, look what this does with your revenue without doing anything else in marketing. So I came back and I'm like, all you guys just go back to pricing law. And I did all the consults for, I don't remember how long, a number of months. I don't know if it was a full year. And then started hiring non-attorney salespeople. And it took me a while, you know, kind of work out the kinks with that. But that was probably those two things. I'd gotten better at delegating the legal work. And I was still doing some of it, mostly the higher level stuff, and occasionally taking a client here or there. But then the other big piece was getting out of the sales process. So that was the first time where once I got those pieces in place, where clients would come in, they would be worked up, cases would be resolved, and they would be closed out. And I wouldn't have any idea. Like, I wouldn't, if you said, you know, what about the Smith case?
That is awesome. That's awesome. Right. You know, It's, you know, the use of non-attorney salespeople, I've heard of some other firms doing this, but it is probably easier in a consumer-facing practice than
true.
Business sort of facing. But man, I mean, that's usually, you know, one of the last pieces is this, the founder has always been good at marketing and sales, and it's the last piece that they get rid of, it seems like, often.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I have some friends who, you know, are more kind of B2B, you know, I have some friends who are in the white collar criminal defense world. And I think that's trickier. You know, I think it can be done, right? I think you just probably, there are attorneys, right, who are salespeople. That's what they do, you know, and so you can have somebody with the JD, you know, who can speak at that level, who's almost more of a business development person, you know, not just necessarily a sales person. So I do think there are some differences. But yeah, that was the biggest change for me in kind of getting myself out of the day-to-day of the business. So yeah.
So another question that is always of interest to me as I'm growing my firm and as you continue to grow yours, you know, as CEO, part of your job is allocation of resources. So, you know, any business, you've got limited resources, time, energy, money, and you've got more ideas and more initiatives than you could ever do. So how do you, Tom, figure out, okay, this is what we're going to do. What's your process of sort of going through that and figuring out, okay, we've got this much time, energy, money, we're going to do this now and we'll save the others for later.
Yeah. A couple of things. Probably so after the sales piece, the next big thing that allowed me to kind of jump forward was hiring a COO. And I, again, got that from How to Manage. I would not have come to this on my own, but I was, you know, kind of in that program, at least at the time. They were like, look, once you get around 1.5 million in revenue, your firm is going to get too big for you to keep your arms around it, you know, and you're going to need, just like there are people who are really good at sales and perhaps better than you are at sales, there are people who are really good at managing resources, perhaps better than you are at managing resources, and you should hire them. And so I did that, but it wasn't with some reluctance on my part, because it was my first, except for some of the attorneys, it was my first six-figure hire. I mean, it was a big deal. And I was trying to do it on the cheap. I was trying to promote a paralegal and don't know if you know how HTM works, but they have kind of their fractional program. You have a fractional CEO. And my CEO at the time, he was just a great guy, was like, don't be like, he's like, just don't be stupid. Like, no, don't promote your paralegal. Like, be a hire, you put on your big boy pants and hire somebody who you can do this right out of the job. And perhaps not strangely, my wife was a huge advocate of this because of my many skill sets, reading a spreadsheet and figuring out, like, you know, how to, like you say, how to allocate those resources. It's just not my, I could do a B minus job, but I've never been, that's not where my head lives. And so I hired, so now I'm not even the CEO, right? So my CEO now is named Brian Formigas. He started out at my COO. And in some ways I got lucky because you'll hear people who hire a COO and have nightmare stories, just like any hire, right? But I kind of got lucky right out of the gate. And Brian had a decade, maybe decades, I can't, I'm sure, management experience in downtown DC firms. And he had just kind of gotten burnt out of the big firm, you know, pre-pandemic, you know, throw on your suit, jump on the metro, head into town every day. And so I kind of caught him on the rebound. He was looking for something else. And it just, it was phenomenal. And it really, when he stepped in, like, honestly, I don't know that the firm would have survived if he hadn't come in, because we were, so I had the non-attorney salespeople, like, you know, everything was going great, but you've heard the phrase like growing gone. Like, I was headed to growing gone, like, because we were bringing in more clients, you know, record-breaking revenue every month, spending, like, just like it was all going out the back end, and some months more than I was bringing in. And I'm not the greatest at math, but I do know if you spend more than you're making, that's not a recipe for longevity. So he came in and just, he was great. I mean, he's like, we need to reset your comp system. We got to change, like, just really pull all these levers. And so he was the next big step. So that really helped us take off, because he took off my plate some things that I was not particularly good at. So he was COO for a number of years, and then I promoted him to CEO about a year ago. So I'm really practically useless. So I'm glad you gave me something to do.
So what are you, your chairman? Is that your title?
That's right. Grand poobah. But I'll tell you another thing that we did, that I'm sure you're familiar with, is we use the EOS, the Entrepreneurial Operating System. I don't know if you guys do that, but I had been a fan, which again, I learned about through the Strategic Coach, which is where I first heard of it, the book Traction, and read it and was like, this is what we need to do. And we tried to implement it on our own for a number of years and did not, I mean, sort of a 30% job. And then we eventually, like, okay, we need to hire a consultant. So we hired one of their implementers through their EOS website. And for 2 years, we did that. And that was another big piece. So in addition to bringing on Brian, they really helped us bring our management team together, really helped us bring some discipline, you know, to our management process. Because I think this is true of a lot of entrepreneurs, like, you're probably the same way. Like, I'm a quick start. Like, I want to try this. I want to try that. Like, you know, which is good and bad, right? Like, it gets a lot of initiatives out there, but a lot of them, like, are smoking heaps off in the corner because you got bored or you weren't good at implementing it. So it just,
you're describing me to a T.
Yeah. So
it frustrates your team, I'm sure. I know it frustrates mine. It's just like, boom,
well,
boom, boom.
Right. Well, that was the great thing about EOS is they get that. They're right. They were like, in a nice way, they're like, look, we get it. He's crazy, right? Like, well, you got to, like, he's crazy. He's going to come in here and he's going to go boom. And you guys have got to, you know, and particularly with Brian, like, be like, okay, let Tom have his whiteboard moment, you know, and then we're going to pick a couple of these ideas and work with the team. And, you know, it's sort of elemental, but it's hard discipline to learn, which was, you know, come up with your rocks or your objectives that you want to accomplish within these 90 days. And you do this all in one day, right? Or maybe two. And then that's it, right? Like, you don't go back and say, like, oh, I'm going to do this. Like, no, you have picked your objectives. All these great ideas, you can put them in the parking lot and we can talk about them for the next quarter. But Tom doesn't get any more ideas in these 90 days. We're just executing on those. And it took us a while. I mean, it took us a number of months. It really took us about 2 years. But that process got a lot better. And so, and then the whole group learned it. So not only, and this kind of happened over a number of years, but so I had Brian as my COO, and then we hired a director of sales, director of marketing, and a managing attorney. So we had a whole C-suite, and the EOS process really helped with that discipline to your question about, okay, we got these resources, how do we allocate them? Because I just was not, that was not my strong suit.
So you've got the EOS system, if you're willing to share, or however much you're willing to share, what's the long-term, or what's your 10-year vision for the firm?
Yeah. So we want to, you know, continue to be, you know, to stay in our niche, right? To stay in employment law, representing individuals, and to continue expand out into this market. You know, the 10-year goal is to be at $30 million in revenue. You know, I think I forget, we've got this all out on our, you know, EOS, you know, they have you lay it out, your vision, and I forget how many employees. I think we had by in 10 years, 100 and some employees. With AI, frankly, I don't know that's going to be necessary, but we'll see. But that's the 10-year goal.
So it sounds like you've sort of found your sweet spot. You get to to do the things that you're good at and that you enjoy. What do they call that? Your, I don't know. There's some more
unique ability.
There you go.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like things are pretty good. Is that?
Yeah, things are good. Yeah, life is good. I'm certainly happier now than I ever have been, you know, and you've experienced this. I think any entrepreneur has. Like there have definitely been some dark, you know, and I think if you're trying to grow that way, that's just going to happen, right? Like there, you just got to learn some things in the school of hard knocks, but I wouldn't trade it. I'm glad that, you know, and really, frankly, sometimes I kept going just because I didn't know of a better option than to just keep on keeping on. I wish I could say it was some, you know, great bravery on my part, but it really wasn't. But I'm glad that I, you know, that for whatever reason, stuck through those times and learned those lessons, because it's entirely possible, I think, in any business. And again, not all attorneys want to do this, and that's fine. If you want to keep your hands in the production, and, you know, some managing attorney loves trying cases, like he's like, I don't think he wouldn't want my life. You know, he wants to stay, which is great. You know, and I think, you know, attorneys can certainly do this, but it is also possible to develop an organization, even a professional services organization, that just runs without you having to steer it.
So you've had a nice career arc from a solo with no business to, you know, you've sort of retired to but you've moved to the chairman role, get to do, you know, your sweet spot there. For the others out there that are thinking about starting their firm, or maybe the early stages, you know, is there any advice that you would give them, you know, things you wish you had known way back then when you started?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I mean, if you've got that itch, then you should just do it, right? I mean, it's entirely possible. And I think what I wish I had known is that it's not easy, but it is not exceptionally difficult to build a firm that will support you in whatever fashion that you want. And I have seen people, I mean, for me, I mean, it was years and years of kind of, you know, grinding away, you know, learning some things here or there. But I've seen people who, you know, using the same knowledge that I wish I had when I had started, which is much more available now than it was in 2009. But I've seen people like start with How to Manage or with another coaching group. And it's not that there aren't hard times. Within a matter of a couple of years, they've got a pretty decent firm that's continuing to grow. So I think get out there and learn. Understand it's going to be hard. That's just part of the way it is. Hard and fun and exhilarating and all those things. But get out there and learn it. Right? Learn how to do the sales, learn how to reach your P&L, learn how to, you know, how to market your practice. And then I think the other piece is, like, there's almost any practice area, any business, anywhere you can make it successful, right? I think when I started, I had a little bit of a lack mentality, like there wasn't enough out there, you know, so I was constantly reaching and grabbing for more. And it doesn't necessarily happen overnight, but if you want to be the T-bone car crash guy, like, you can do that. It might take a little bit, but there are enough T-bone car crashes out there for you to do it. And in any market, like, I remember, this is not my practice, but I remember meeting with a guy who was just starting out his practice in the DC area. He was starting out in personal injury, and he had some experience, you know, good attorney. And I remember talking to him, and he wasn't spending a lot on digital marketing, and he didn't have much of a website. And I was like, and I don't do personal injury, I don't know, but I'm like, I think it's pretty competitive. I think you're going to need to spend some more on that. And I was wrong. Like, that guy grew his practice pretty steadily, by doing networking. Like he would have two lunches with people, and he was a good attorney, so it wasn't just that. I mean, like he was doing a great job with the cases that he got, but he was having two lunches religiously. And I mean, I could tell, like I would come up on his Rolodex every now and then, like he'd call me back up, you know, to go get lunch. And he's now got a thriving practice. And of course, now he does the PPC, he does the website. But that's just an example of this was somebody who started out with no resources, without a ton of experience, who just kind of in a pick and shovel fashion built himself a thriving personal injury law firm in an area where there are a lot of personal injury lawyers. So I think that's another thing I would like to have known too, is like, pick what you want and stick at it. There are enough people out there to make you a success that need your services.
That's something that, you know, part of my practice representing law firms, one of the cool things is that I get to see so many different types of practices that are kicking ass. You know, there's low volume, high volume, plaintiff side, defense side, this weird little niche over here that nobody's ever heard of. And then there's this thing over here and people are doing it. They're figuring it out. It's just like you said, I think another key is you need to do something that at least, you know, I don't really like the word passion, but it's something that at least is going to hold your interest. It's got to be interesting to you or else you're going to hate it.
Great point. And I'll tell you, just going back to my early days. So I, you know, because I was coming out of the, you know, U.S. Attorney's Office. So like one of the obvious things for me to do was do criminal defense. And I was working with a coach at the time who's like, well, start with that because that's what you know. And you can add other practices later. And I think that's not necessarily bad advice. But to your point, like I didn't have the passion. Like I could do it and I actually like my clients quite a bit, but like I wasn't interested enough to be able to sit down and write about it every day and think about it. And that's really what helped me pick employment law, because I, you know, that was an area that, like you said, I don't think you necessarily have to be, you know, kind of bleeding heart like you love. And it's okay if you are, like, great. Some people have that really kind of passion for, you know, a particular area. So it doesn't necessarily have to be that, but you have to have enough, as you say, enough in the tank that you're willing to come back every day and chip away and write about, you know, or get out there and network on whatever topic that it is. So I do think that it's got to have, and I got this from Arjun Robbins. He's like, there's a number of different ways you can love your practice. You can love your clients, right? You can love the law and you can love the business model. And it doesn't have to be all three. Like it could be just one of those. Maybe you just love the clients. Maybe you just love that area of the law. Maybe you love, you know, that business model. Like you said, maybe you like doing kind of the, you know, high volume and that turns you on and you love tearing down your practices, building it back up, you know, and thinking about it. So there are a lot of ways to be successful, but it's got to be something that you've got the endurance for.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. So I know I've kept you here for a while. Why don't you tell everybody if they want to get in touch with you and buy your book or whatever, how can they find you?
Yeah, sure. You can find me, you know, find our website, so spigolaw.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. Always happy to connect people there. We do have a new book out called Fired or Afraid That You Might Be. That is now up on Amazon. So you can go there and get you a hard copy. I forget what the hard copy is. The Kindle version is like $1. So you can go get our book for $1 there. And you can also find the book on our website.
And I'll say, I like your post on LinkedIn. You dropped some good wisdom on there. So keep doing that. And I get a lot out of that. So thank you.
I appreciate that. Well, it's been fun. Yeah, thanks for having me on, John.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Founding Partner Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. You can also connect with Jonathan on LinkedIn and check out the show notes with links to resources mentioned throughout our discussion by visiting www.yourlawfirmgc.com. We'll see you next time for more origin stories and insights from successful law firm founders.